Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Historian Patrick Mason has been named the new Leonard J. Arrington Endowed Chair of Mormon History and Culture at Utah State University. The Arrington Chair is the first such Mormon Studies professorial chair in the world. It's housed in the Religious Studies program within the History Department. Patrick Mason is giving his inaugural lecture in this position. That's on Wednesday, October 16th, 7:30 p.m. in the USU Performance Hall. And it's free and open to the public. To the point, Patrick Mason, that we're encouraging people, even predictably, universities have parking issues. And I know people in the community maybe roll their eyes, oh, it's up at the university, right? And there's a parking lot being torn up right now near the performance hall. But so the parking is across the street to the east of the Fine Arts Center. But you can take a golf cart. They're
this
providing golf carts.
I mean, why wouldn't you want to ride a golf cart to a history lecture?
So come just to get that ride in the golf cart, right?
Exactly. VIP treatment.
Right. So it's free and open to the public. We hope people come. So Patrick Mason, one of your latest books is What is Mormonism? A Student's Introduction. Planted, interesting book. We'll get to talking about that. That's about faith.
Right.
Right?
Right.
In some of your experiences and people you talk to.
That's right.
Also upcoming books, The Battles of Zion, Mormonism and Violence, and its bookend Weapons of Peace, A Mormon Theology of Nonviolence. So we'd hope to get to all those as
Sure. And the Mormonism and Violence book is actually out now. It came out this summer just
a month or two ago. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Your dissertation was on, your first book was on violence. Right?
That's right.
Against religious minorities.
That's right. Yeah, I went to graduate school at the University of Notre Dame, which was a terrific experience, and I became very interested there. I actually had developed this interest earlier as an undergraduate at BYU, but at Notre Dame, I became very interested in issues of both violence and peace, how it is that human societies always say that they want peace and end up doing violence against one another, either against external enemies or internal enemies. So I became really interested in this theme of violence in American history, and I've always been interested in religion. And so my dissertation tried to figure out what was going on in the South in the late 19th century. This is after the Civil War, after Reconstruction, and how did religious minorities fare? So obviously black Christians, but we know the African-American experience, but also Catholics and Jews, and then also Latter-day Saints.
Mm. What would you say, just in general, about studying religion in an academic setting, before we get to the Mormon part, right?
Yeah.
I've had a few, it's not a majority, it's a handful of people who have contacted me after episodes such as this one and have said, why are you talking about religion?
Right.
What, you know, this is a secular radio program. It's a secular university. Well, you know, cool it with the religion. So I guess that's my way of providing context to this question, studying religion.
Well, I'd say there's kind of two or three. Actually, we could spend a long time talking about this. But I'd say two or three answers in brief. So one is simply that religion is an enormous aspect of human society and human civilization, right? So whether or not you yourself are religious, whether you like religion, don't like religion, you can't ignore religion if you want to understand human sociology, human psychology, that the way, certainly history, the way that we've organized our societies, especially in the West, but really in anywhere, almost anywhere around the world. And so it's just, if we want to understand the human condition, religion as part of it, like it or not. But I think a second part of it is, as you say, you use this word secular. We're at a secular university, a state university. Why would you study religion here, right? It's one thing to study at the University of Notre Dame or at BYU, where I went to school. But why would you study religion here? Well, again, it's part of the human condition. But also, you know, secularism, there's lots of varieties of secularism. And in fact, the Supreme Court in the mid-20th century made very clear that public institutions in this country can teach about religion, they just can't teach religion. And they made that distinction. And so, no, in a religious studies program, we don't promote any particular religious doctrine or institution or worldview. But we believe very strongly that religious literacy is a core component of citizenship, and that if you want to be a good neighbor, a good citizen, a good student of the world around you, religion is an essential component of that.
So what about Mormon history? This is the Leonard J. Arrington Endowed Chair of Mormon History and Culture. is the official title of the chair you hold.
Right. And so this is distinctive. As you noted, this is the first of these positions anywhere in the world. There's now three. There's one at Claremont Graduate University and another at the University of Virginia. But this was the first. And what an endowed chair is, it simply means that private funds have been donated in order to support the study of a particular thing. It could be anything. You could have a chair in evolutionary biology or in accounting or anything. This just happened to be in Mormon history in the religious studies program. And what that means is these funds mean that this particular topic, Mormon history and culture, will be in perpetuity. It'll be part of the faculty and part of the curriculum here at Utah State University. And again, I think it's entirely appropriate, especially here, given the Mormon culture region, given where we sit here in Utah State University as the land-grant university in the state of Utah, where still the majority of people identify with the LDS Church. It makes a lot of sense that would be part of the curriculum, that we understand the history, the culture. Again, this is not to propagate the faith. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, that's its job, right? But as scholars, we're here to, and I'm here to understand the history, the culture, the theology, the practices of the church, the institution, and actually I'm even more interested in the people than in the institution per se.
The people. So that's history and culture and people,
right,
is your focus. Right?
Yeah, and it's one of the reasons why, you know, it's still called Mormon history and culture. I know the M word is now somewhat controversial, but I actually think it's still appropriate to use that word when we're talking about the history, the culture, because that includes, but it's also bigger than the institution itself. And there are a lot of people who no longer identify with the institution, but still feel some kind of affinity with Mormon culture, Mormon history. And so I still think it's appropriate for us to use that word in a kind of expansive way to include institutional church history, but actually go well beyond that.
Would these studies include offshoot branches, FLDS, so those sorts of...
Yeah, it's another reason why the term is helpful. So when we, you know, in the classroom next semester, I'll be teaching a course called Mormonism and the American Religious Experience. And yes, it'll be dominated by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and its members. That is the majority expression of the tradition of these diverse traditions and dozens, if not hundreds, of traditions that trace their origins back to Joseph Smith and his revelations. But absolutely, we would consider fundamentalist Mormonism, of which there is a huge variety, of course. We'd consider the former Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, now Community of Christ, and then a whole number of other offshoots. And offshoots, nobody likes to be said they're part of an offshoot, right? I mean, many of these traditions feel like they are the true inheritors of the tradition. They're not just breakoffs of the LDS Church. And so all of that variety, for me, that's part of the fascinating part of it. It's just like when you study Christianity, you're studying, you know, I mean, hundreds, if not thousands, of expressions of it. In the Mormon tradition, you've got dozens, if not hundreds, of expressions of it.
I want to get into just a little bit of your background. You were raised in Utah?
Yeah, raised in Sandy.
In Sandy. Went to BYU.
That's right.
And then Notre Dame.
Mm-hmm.
So you might point out a couple of private institutions.
Right.
Kind of religiously based. Is that how you got into studying religious history?
Yeah, I suppose so. I'm one of these strange kids who knew exactly what I wanted to do when I went to college. I mean, I went to BYU on day one. I declared as a history major. American history was always what I wanted to do, what I've been fascinated with for a long time. It was at BYU that I became interested in religious history, and then that's what took me to Notre Dame, which is one of the great graduate programs in American religious history. So, yeah, no doubt I think that environment of both of those schools shaped my interests in religious history. But I think I could have gotten there through any number of routes. A number of my colleagues in the field of religious studies, they went through secular schools as well. So it's not only private religious universities where you can study religion.
Mm-hmm. So history is a broad field.
Yeah,
you're interested in in religion?
Yeah, religion, and like I said, primarily American history, but then I became very interested in religion and American history. But I also have spent a lot of time studying race in American history. Actually, when I first went to graduate school, I thought there was a pretty decent chance, and I spent my first couple of years focusing mostly on African-American history, African-American religious history, and then things sort of evolved from there. And that remains a major interest of mine. So I've always been interested in modern American history, especially 19th and 20th century. I don't do so much with the 17th and 18th centuries, although, of course, I'm trained in those areas. So modern U.S. history and trying to understand this civilization, this society that we live in.
I think you're going to talk a bit about this in your lecture, which, by the way, the inaugural lecture for Patrick Mason as he assumes the Leonard J. Arrington Endowed Chair of Mormon History and Culture at Utah State University is October 16th. That's a Wednesday, 7:30 p.m. in the USU Performance Hall on the USU campus. Parking is in the lot across the street to the east of the Fine Arts Center, and there's golf cart shuttling. Mm-hmm. It's free and open to the public. You're going to talk about doing history, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the title of my talk is the politics of Mormon history. And really what I mean there, I'm not talking about politics in terms of midterm elections or impeachment or anything like that. I'm talking about the politics of what does it mean for us to live together? What does it mean to study history in the context of community? And here we've got two different kinds of communities. You've got an academic community on the one hand, which is largely secular. And then, of course, you've got a religious history. And when you're studying religious history, one of the interesting aspects of it, one of the challenges but also opportunities, is that you're dealing with a community of people who really care about this stuff, right? It's not like I'm studying, I don't know, the economy of a 12th century French village. Now maybe somebody who's really passionate about that, right? But most people don't bank their salvation on that. And so when you're talking about religious history, you're talking about something that strikes very close to home for a lot of people, in this case, millions of people around the world. And Mormon history, it's all so recent, right? It's, you know, if I was doing, you know, Jewish history and I was doing something, you know, before the Common Era, or even if I was doing Catholic history and I was talking about medieval Catholic history, I think there's a kind of distance there that people are comfortable with. But there's no such thing as distance in Mormon history. I mean, just next year will be the 200th anniversary of Joseph Smith's first vision. So it all feels very recent. It all feels very relevant. And so I'm going to talk about how it is that historians do that. How do we navigate those treacherous shoals? And what do historians owe the community, but also what does the community owe the historians who study it? Mm.
So we'll not have you give your lecture here. People have to come to it, right?
Yeah,
so
you got to say for it. I'm not going to give away the punchline.
Right. but I do want to just treat this a little briefly, and then we'll go to break, and then when we come back, I want to talk about current LDS history and future. Maybe a way to get into this is to ask you about Leonard Arrington. This is the Leonard J. Arrington Endowed Chair. And where do you think we are now in terms of doing Mormon history vis-a-vis the institutional church?
Yeah.
Which is often the elephant in the room, right? And there's, you know, the more and less openness is, you know, from the institutional church. So Arrington himself, I think that the fact that he was appointed church historian,
right,
was seen by as a watershed moment by many. And there's been oscillation in that over time. Where do you think we are now?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, I mean, we can't treat Leonard Arrington's career in just a nutshell, but he was a professor here at Utah State University and a nationally renowned historian of the West, historian of American economic history, but also historian of Mormonism. And in a lot of ways, he is the grandfather or the godfather of the field of Mormon history. We all stand on his shoulders. And because what Arrington did is he pioneered a version of history that was neither polemical nor apologetic. So, but before Arrington, and there were a few other people, he didn't do this alone. But before him, people talked about Mormon history, but you were either for or against. And Arrington said, what would it look like if we just looked at the evidence, the way that historians look at other kinds of evidence, and we weren't either trying to argue for or against the church, we were just trying to treat the evidence and be responsible historians. And sometimes that's going to look good for the church, sometimes it will look bad for the church. But we're not doing it for the church. We're doing it for the sake of history and historical understanding. And that's what the whole field is built upon. What's significant is that then Arrington was appointed the official historian of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So he went from being a professor at a state school here at Utah State University to being a church employee. And in a lot of ways, there was a golden era of history where he revolutionized the way that history was done within the church. And he brought on this team of amazing historians who are now the senior scholars in the field, and some have even passed on, like Arrington himself. But then some of the church leaders got uncomfortable with that kind of transparent, open, honest, what they saw as a too secular rendering of the history. And so Arrington and his team got moved down to BYU. Now the church historians are always general authorities of the church. But the interesting thing is that now, a half century later, the church has essentially come back to where Arrington was in the 1960s and 70s, recognizing that transparency, that openness, that fidelity to the historical record is going to be the best way to move forward. And so in a lot of ways, we are basking in a kind of second Arringtonian era, if I could coin a term, and we all very much stand on his shoulders.
There, and I'm probably stepping into your lecture here again, but historians such as yourself are, I think, always going to be accused of being on. You know, you try to thread the needle, right?
Yeah.
The way Arrington tried to do, but on one side you're going to be accused of being too polemical, on the other side maybe too apologetic.
Yeah, I think, you know, for a lot of scholars and scholars of religion, the safe thing to do is take a purely secular approach. And I mean, we have to take a secular approach. We're in the secular academy, but to take a purely critical approach that would score a lot of points within the academy. And let's face it, most people aren't reading most scholars' work, and so you can get away with that. But I think when we do deal with communities that are alive, that are thriving, that care about their history, I think that scholars have a responsibility not to tell the community story the way that they want that story to be told. Again, our primary responsibility is to the evidence, to the history, to the record that we see it, and then we do our best kind of good faith interpretation and analysis of that record. But I think, and what we've seen over the past, I don't know, 20 years or so, is religious historians and religious studies adopt a kind of posture of generosity towards their subjects. Some of the leading scholars in the field are even talking about how, and this is not just Mormon historians, within the broader field of religious studies, that you have to take things like angels and spirits and visions seriously, right? You can't just dismiss them as kind of a psychosis or you know, kind of the leftover of somebody's bad meal or something like that, or mental illness, that actually, what would it look like to take seriously the human engagement with a world beyond this one? Now, that's controversial, and some scholars reject that and say we have to take a purely materialist view of our subject. But this is part of the debate that really makes the field rich, is what do we do with all these claims of supernatural intervention in this world? Can we take them seriously? Can we treat angels as historical actors, or do we have to dismiss that entirely?
Hmm. By the way, Mormonism, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, is an American-grown institution. Not the only one, maybe the most prominent one this time. I know that's fascinating to you, right, studying American history.
Yeah,
history has bred these religions.
Well, and that's one of the reasons I love it. And many of my colleagues in the field, and this is what I tell my students all the time, is that we have this amazing laboratory, right? If you care about religion, the kinds of questions that come up with religion, right, like interactions with the supernatural, like questions of authority, like how humans build community or shape their families, all these kinds of questions that come up, you know, the evolution of doctrine, right? I mean, Mormonism gives us a laboratory that is richly documented, that is recent. We can see a religion grow right before our eyes, right? I mean, any historian would, I mean, just pay a pound of flesh to be able to get in a time machine and go back and watch the first two centuries of Christianity or of Islam, right? What would it look like to watch a religion get born and grow and emerge in the context of a culture, but then also try to transcend that culture? right? And so, you know, my colleagues who study early Christianity, they're always working with just fragments of documents, right? I mean, a papyrus scroll here, you know, and stuff is always missing. We don't have any of the originals of any of the New Testament texts, right? But with Mormonism, it's all right there. I mean, there's still gaps in the record. We're always complaining about things we don't know. But actually, compared with any other religion, it's so well documented that it is just a playground for a historian, for a scholar of religion to be able to study big questions, not just Mormon questions, but big human questions through the lens and experience of Mormonism.
As you pointed out, not yet 200 years old.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's still very, very young.
Yeah.
I mean, the current president of the church, Russell M. Nelson, is 95 years old. He's lived almost half of the entire history of the religion. That's remarkable.
Yeah. Fodder for study, right? That's and for fresh sources. Right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I want to get it later in the hour. I want to get into some of these big questions you talked about that you can see through the lens of religion, especially a new religion. Let's take a break first. We've been overdue for a break. We're talking with Patrick Mason. He is a historian and has been named recently the Leonard J. Arrington Endowed Chair of Mormon History and Culture at Utah State University. And his inaugural lecture is Wednesday, October 16th, 7:30 p.m. in the USU Performance Hall. It's free and open to the public. Don't worry about the parking. The parking is in the lot across the street from the east of the Fine Arts Center, but you can take the golf cart to the lecture. So I really want you to come. More following this break.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Science Unwrapped in USU's College of Science. Food for thought this Friday at 7 in the Eccles Science Learning Center with nutritional scientist Carrie Durward. Information at usu.edu/unwrapped.
On the next Putumayo World Music Hour, we'll celebrate Oktoberfest, not with polkas and accordions, although we do have some accordions, but with some of the hip, sophisticated music being created by German musicians, producers, and club DJs today. I'm Rosalie Howarth. Join me for Oktoberfest on the next Putumayo World Music Hour.
Join us Friday night at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
Utah Public Radio is broadcasting engaging and impactful stories of Utah 24 hours, 7 days a week on the air. But we have a lot more to say, and so much more for you to hear. The UPR social media team is bringing you Utah's most important stories right to your feed. Stay up to date and join the discussion by connecting with us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Pinterest. Don't forget to use the hashtag IAMUPR. Why wait? Pick up your mobile device now and get the most out of Utah Public Radio. And just as always, stay tuned for more on the air from UPR.
You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. I have with me historian Patrick Mason. He's the new Leonard J. Arrington Endowed Chair of Mormon History and Culture at Utah State University. And he's giving his inaugural lecture in this position. That's on Wednesday, October 16th at 7:30 p.m. in the USU Performance Hall. It's free and open to the public. The parking is in the lot across the street to the east of the Fine Arts Center, and there is golf cart shuttling to the lecture. You recently participated, Patrick Mason, in a podcast. I'll give a shout out to our friends at Salt Lake Tribune,
mm-hmm.
their Mormonland podcast.
Yeah,
I'll shout out another partnership on Fridays. Hope you'll join us Fridays. Hope you do join us on Fridays, 9 a.m. In this time slot for Behind the Headlines, which is another partnership with Salt Lake Tribune and KCBW in Salt Lake City. So this podcast was about the tenure of Russell M. Nelson as president of the church. It's what, year and a half or something?
A little over that.
Not yet 2 years. A lot has happened. And so that's kind of a lens to see where the church is today and the changes and where it might be going. What are the top things top of mind during these last 2 years that interest you?
A lot of things come to mind. I mean, what's remarkable to me is that I don't think anybody expected, certainly nobody that I know, expected the pace of change, the amount of change that we've seen over the past not quite 2 years. I mean, President Nelson came into the position, I think he was 93 when he became president of the church. He's never been seen as a as a guy who would shake things up. I think seen as a real kind of company man, and you know, kind of toe the line. And so I predicted, and everybody else predicted, more or less a status quo presidency. It's been anything but that. But I think a couple of things that I would note is that we haven't seen any significant changes to the doctrine of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. It's all been around policy, around practices, around organization, about the way that the way that the church leaders understand that doctrine, the way that it gets implemented and executed. And with that, we've just seen a phenomenal amount of change to almost every aspect of the church. It's going to be seen as a time of real change. And I think it's fair to say that the church was maybe stuck in a little bit of a rut for the past, I don't know, 20 or 30 years, that kind of been doing the same thing that had been doing for a long time. A few announcements here or there, building new temples and things like that, but mostly a kind of keep going as it's going. And I think President Nelson and the other senior leaders of the church recognize that that's not going to be good enough as we move further into the 21st century, that the church organized itself for phenomenal success in the 20th century. I mean, this incredible growth to become a worldwide tradition of 15, 16 million members. But that growth is slowing, especially in the United States and Western Europe, that there are real challenges, that the world has changed, that the culture has changed, and so that the religion has to change with it. And so far, it's all these internal changes in terms of how to manage that. We'll see if there are any, there will be more changes. I mean, the one thing I'm confident as a historian is that there will always be change. That's what history is. It's the study of change over time. Sometimes it's gradual, sometimes it's rapid. We're in a period of rapid change for the institutional church right now.
There is a tension. You pointed this out in the lecture at Chautauqua that I was viewing. There is a tension between growth in, say, Africa.
Yeah.
And other areas where the societies are much more conservative, and where maybe if a policy is on the more conservative end of the sliding scale, it's going to play better in those areas versus U.S. or Europe. And I guess the church leaders are having to navigate that.
Well, you're exactly right. And in this way, the church leaders are having to navigate the same kinds of questions that other truly global religions have done, especially now where you've got a secularizing West, where the norms and values are tending towards the liberal and progressive. And then you've got a global South where those norms and values still tend to be traditional and conservative, especially around issues of gender, sexuality, marriage, these kinds of quote-unquote moral issues. And so we've seen this in the Anglican Communion, we've seen this in Methodism, we've seen this in the Roman Catholic Church. How do you maintain a kind of single communion, a single church? I mean, all these churches prize unity, and the LDS Church, I mean, unity is one of the primary values. How do you hold a church together when you've got these global cultures that are so far apart? And so you've got an increasing number of American Mormons who want to see movement on things like LGBT issues and gender issues, women's issues, whereas is actually the church's traditionalism is precisely one of the things that fuels its growth in places like Western Africa, in the Philippines, in other places, that still those traditional values are important, and they're trying to hold on to those traditional values. They see the church as an asset in doing so, whereas in the United States, it's becoming increasingly complicated.
Well, talk a little bit about LGBTQ.
Yeah.
Community and the church's stand, you know, policies toward that community. It seemed like there was a bit of liberalization, a bit of opening up, and then a bit of a contraction, and then now right. Very recently a bit more retrenching. I wonder if you talk a little bit about that, and where do you think it's going to go?
Yeah, well, I think we have to set this against the background, the context, that in terms of LGBTQ issues, I mean, when we look at the history of the United States, there is no kind of social issue where there's been such rapid change across the culture in such a short amount of time, right? You look at, you know, rights for racial minorities, that took centuries to evolve. And of course, we're still wrestling with that. Women's issues, all these kinds of things. LGBT issues, I mean, it was, as I was growing up, it was a non-issue, right? And that was only 30, 35 years ago here in the Wasatch Front. And now, of course, the majority of the culture is in favor of same-sex marriage, which has been legalized in the Supreme Court, and full equality for LGBTQ communities and individuals. And so churches, like everybody else, are wrestling with this. And you're exactly right. The LDS Church has gone from a position of essentially complete rejection of homosexuality, of LGBTQ individuals, 30 or 40 years ago, to now much more openness. But they've got this doctrine that was enshrined in what's called the Family Proclamation from 1995 that talks about how marriage is between a man and a woman, and how gender is an essential characteristic of a person's identity. And last week, President Dallin Oaks, who's the first counselor in the first presidency, said, when we said gender, what we meant was biological sex in terms of it being binary, that God intends for people to be in a binary male-female duality. And he says, we recognize that there's variation in the human family. We recognize that there's complications. He said, we can't fully explain that. We don't know that. But what we do know, or what we do teach, is that it's meant to be on a biological sex binary. And so the church is, but at the same time, the church, I think, has made great strides in terms of trying to communicate openness and support for the LGBTQ community, both within the church and outside, in terms of legislation, some partnerships in the state of Utah, some other things like that. So they're wrestling with this, right? And in some ways, they've got critics on both sides who think that the church is either going too far or not far enough.
President Nelson gave a very interesting presentation explaining why the church had, because a couple of years ago, they had restricted, made more strict rules about children.
That's right.
Of LGBT couples, which they then fairly recently reversed.
That's right.
And President Nelson explained one of the reasons was they had felt pain among the people, right?
Yeah. And this was so remarkable. You're right. I mean, this November 2015 policy, which prohibited the baptism of children who were raised in same-sex households where there was a same-sex marriage or a couple. And then that policy gets reversed 3 years later, which is remarkably fast for the LDS Church. Usually, I mean, there's always change, but oftentimes it's generational, not in terms of a matter of a few years. And there wasn't much explanation at the time when the policy was reversed several months ago. It was only a few weeks ago when President Nelson went down to BYU and explained this. And you're exactly right. He said that one of the reasons why is that the church leaders heard all these stories of pain from the LGBT community, but also now increasingly, I mean, almost everybody has a friend, a family member, a coworker, somebody who's LGBT, So the pain that was associated with that policy, I think that I think what the church leadership would say would be unintended consequences of that policy. They realized it wasn't doing what they wanted to be doing, and in fact, it was inflicting a lot of harm. And so they felt appropriate to change that policy, to reverse it.
Some people in the church, some people outside the church, want to see changes, and I think they wonder. And this is an example of perhaps feelings of members of the church had a hand in changing a policy. And on the other hand, the church is very top down in structure.
Yeah.
There's an interesting question that was posed at this podcast I made reference to. The moderator said, do you think ordained women and other organizations will have an effect? That's an interesting question. How much How much change do you think percolates from the bottom up?
Yeah, the fact is that it does. It comes from the bottom up as well as the top down. You know, the image of the LDS Church is that it's entirely hierarchical. It's entirely top down. And frankly, that's part of the image that the leadership wants to give, that they don't want to open themselves up to what they call pressure groups or interest groups within the church. One of the core doctrines of the church is that it's led by revelation, that these are prophets who are led, inspired by God. So, you know, why do you need, you know, ideas from the bottom up if ideas are coming from God? But the fact is, you go throughout the two centuries of Mormon history, there have always been changes that have come from the bottom up, including a number of things that are now central to what the church does. I mean, you know, it's programs for children, it's welfare projects, you know, all these kinds of things. They started at the local level first, and then they filtered up. And there's no doubt that ordained women has changed the conversation within Mormon culture, which has also then changed the conversation at the leadership level, both local and general. And so now there's consequences for many of the leaders of these groups who try to apply pressure to the church. There have been a string of excommunications. But I don't think, you know, we could possibly say that they have no impact. I mean, they do change the conversation. They force the leaders to ask different kinds of questions. Sometimes the leaders will retrench and say, no, we're going to keep doing what we're doing. But other times they're going to say, you know what, maybe there's a different way of doing this.
Talk to me about the recent changes regarding women. So there's, you know, not doctrinal, but procedural.
Yeah. So a whole host of things. I mean, there have been changes in the ceremony in LDS temples that I think address a lot of women's concerns to make that ceremony more equitable, certainly in its rhetoric and discourse and approach towards women. There have been just recent changes in how women can witness, stand as witnesses in the church's ordinances or rituals, which previously had been only men had been able to do that. Women's voices have been elevated in leadership positions, both at the local and general level. And in fact, a number of the major changes that were made this past weekend to the Young Women's Program of the church, they were announced not by the president of the church, even though he was there. So typically the president of the church would announce these things, but actually he let the president of the Young Women's Organization announce the changes. Now, the women always serve at the behest of men in the church. This is one of the critiques, is that even where women are given more and more power, they still always serve underneath a man. It's never the other way around. But the fact is that we have seen pretty significant change, even though it's incremental change, raising the profile, prominence, and participation of women within the LDS Church.
One of the topics raised in this podcast, again, this is Mormon Land, make another plug for the Salt Lake Tribune podcast, talked about Second Coming. And the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is not the only one that preaches Second Coming. It is right there in the name of the church,
right?
Latter-day Saints. And the question that was posed was, of course, this podcast was focused on Russell M. Nelson as president of the church. And he has emphasized Second Coming. I wonder what you would say about that. You talked about apocalypticism, and it was interesting that one of the moderators talked about, framed it as a conservative. You pointed out that this is more these days among liberals and progressives.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's no doubt that there's more talk now within the church about the second coming of Jesus Christ than I've heard in a long, long time. I mean, this used to be a regular feature of Mormon teaching in the 19th century all the way up through the mid-20th century. It kind of dropped off in the late 20th, that it never disappeared. It is in the name of the church, but it wasn't as prominent. President Nelson has brought it back. This most recent general conference, I can't count the number of speakers who at least mentioned the second coming and talked about the church preparing the world for the second coming. That's part of the job of the members. So on the one hand, it feels like a throwback. But yeah, the point I made the other night is that we actually hear a lot of talk of apocalypticism right now. It's very in vogue, but it's not from these millennialist religious communities. It's mostly from the secular left, and it's around the climate crisis. That, you know, the rhetoric from scientists to activists at the UN is the world is going to end, and it's going to end badly, and it's going to end pretty soon unless we do something about it. Now, there that the talk is all about how do we stop the apocalypse from coming, whereas in for millenarian religions like the LDS Church, it's how do we help usher in the second coming, because it's seen as a positive thing, right? Jesus is going to come, and then we'll have a world of peace and righteousness and so forth. But actually, I think this apocalyptic language, it's not going to fall on deaf ears, because this is the language that especially millennials and Gen Z folks, you know, this is what they're immersed in, just from the other side of the coin.
Depending on your view of millenarianism, that has an effect on what you're going to view about climate change, isn't it? Sometimes I think some millenarian religions, or at least adherents of those religions, say, well, Jesus is going to come, he's going to take care of everything, we don't need to worry about climate change.
Yeah, that's right. All you have to do is save souls. I mean, one of the most famous preachers of the late 19th century United States was a guy named Dwight Moody, who was very much a millenarian, and he said that this world is a sinking vessel, and God gave me a lifeboat and said, Moody, save all you can, right? I mean, so the world's going, you know, to hell in a handbucket, and all we can do is save souls. But there's another view that actually, yes, Jesus is coming, the world is going to end, but it's our job and our calling to prepare the earth to yes, not only save souls, but actually to do whatever we can to preserve something of this world. And then there's another view that says, actually, Jesus won't come again until we've created a society and a world that is worthy of him. And so there's a way that even this view in Jesus' coming could impel you towards saving the world, not just saving souls, but actually creating a society of justice, of equal rights, of human dignity, but also one that is responsible for the world that we live in, stewardship of the environment.
Before we go to another break, I just wanted to bring up another topic. You've talked about, this is in the context of a new push by the church. We're talking about the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints here, for the worship to be home-centered and church-supported. Recently, the meetings were reduced from 3 hours to two. Great rejoicing among some members of the religion.
Most, I think.
Yeah. You've expressed a concern about what you call the Mormon village.
Yeah, you know, this is a distinctive feature of Mormon life, especially in the Mormon culture region here, from kind of southeastern Idaho through Utah and into certain places in Arizona, that throughout the 19th and much of the 20th century, I mean, Mormons created these villages, these small towns, or even sort of the ward structure of the LDS Church creates a kind of village structure even within larger communities. The people really knew each other. People spent a lot of time with one another. There were deep bonds of community, of solidarity that were built. I mean, people were a part of one another's lives. They helped raise each other's kids. When somebody was sick, they took care of one another. I mean, people knew. Now there are downsides of that, right? I mean, you know, the kind of small town life, everybody's in your business. But I think the upsides are really pretty remarkable. And I think it's true, as the church grows, as wards become more spread out, now as we see each other even less and less, that the church has put a lot of emphasis on trying to limit the number of meetings in order for people to spend more time with families. I think that's all for the better. But there is a cost, and I think the cost is community. And I predicted, and I think this has been true, that the move from 3 to 2 hour church, while there are a lot of upsides and the church experience in many ways is less tedious than it once was, the fact is that people just don't spend very much time with each other. And I think we've got to see how that's going to play out. We're in a society, we're in a culture where the bonds of community are weakening all the time. There are so many pressures, especially in Western culture, that dilute those bonds of community. The LDS Church was one of the things pushing back against that and still will. But I just wonder, if people don't have FaceTime with one another, how do they build community?
I want to follow up with that. There is fragmentation, right?
Yeah.
And of course,
the
political,
bowling alone phenomenon.
Yeah,
right?
Political polarization,
yeah.
And just in so many ways, we feel our society fragmenting. I guess religion can be one of those unifying
forces? And this was one of the beautiful things about a Mormon ward is that, look, I mean, most Mormons in the United States are conservative and there's a great deal of homogeneity. But it's not entirely homogeneous, and people do have different ideas, not only about religion but about politics and about the way to raise kids and so forth. But when you spend a lot of time together in a community, right, when I've taught your kids in a church class or when I've helped you moved in or when you baked a casserole for me when I was sick or, you know, it helped me through a tough time, I'm willing to forgive a lot of your crazy ideas, right? And the bonds that we form together, religious, social, communal bonds, those transcend whatever differences we have. But if we don't spend that time together, and if we're not interacting with each other in those kinds of ways, then it's the things that divide us that become more prominent than the things that unite us. And that's what I'm worried about.
Now, that same unity, that's those same bonds, can be excluding, right?
Absolutely.
You know, the Mormon ward can be so cohesive that if you're not a member of that, you can feel left out.
And I think a lot of people in the Mormon culture region who aren't with the church or have left the church or, quote unquote, less active in the church feel that. There can be a kind of cold shoulder phenomenon, horrible stories about kids not letting their, you know, or parents not letting their kids play with other kids and things like that. So there always is a downside to strong communities, to cohesive communities. And maybe it is, I think, at least in the United States, Latter-day Saints are doing better right now at engaging in other kinds of communities, right, and not just being with other Latter-day Saints. So there's always pluses and minuses. There's always a give and take here. But is there a way to do both and? Is there a way to be inclusive and to be fully part of the broader communities, the diverse communities of which we're a part, while also maintaining these bonds within the ward? Is there a way to do both of those things?
Let's take a break. When we come back, I do want to talk about Planted. The subtitle is Belief and Belonging in an Age of Doubt. I want to talk about those big questions as well.
Yeah.
And we'll only have about 6 minutes to do this. So,
lightning round.
Lightning round. There you go. Well, you have Patrick Mason with us. He is the new Leonard J. Arrington Endowed Chair of Mormon History and Culture at Utah State University. His inaugural lecture is Wednesday, October 16th, 7:30 p.m. in the USU Performance Hall, free and open to the public. Parking is on the lot across the street to the east of the Fine Arts Center, and there will be golf cart shuttling available. More following this break.
Hi, I'm Steve Williams, host of Jazz Time here on Utah Public Radio. I hope you'll join me Sunday evenings for a journey through the world of jazz music, from ragtime to bop, from Havana to Logan, Utah. Tune in for a bit of history, commentary, the occasional interview, and of course, all that jazz. Jazz Time, Sunday evenings at 6 o'clock on Utah Public Radio.
Are you looking for a way to make your nonprofit organization more visible to our statewide community? Utah Public Radio's community calendar highlights events across the state, including music concerts, live theater, classes, workshops, art shows, lectures, festivals, volunteer opportunities, and much, much more. Just check out upr.org and head to our community calendar page. There you'll find our user-friendly submission link and the submission guidelines.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. I'm talking with historian Patrick Mason. He's the new Leonard J. Arrington Endowed Chair of Mormon History and Culture at Utah State University. He's giving his inaugural lecture on Wednesday, October 16th at 7:30 p.m. in the USU Performance Hall. You are invited. It's free and open to the public. Parking is in the lot across the street to the east of the Fine Arts Center. Golf cart shuttling will be available to take you from there to the performance hall. Just have about 5 minutes left and perhaps treat this and another couple of your books, Patrick Mason, in a future conversation, mm-hmm. which I hope you'll come back. But I wanted to treat Planted. This is a very interesting book and personal in many ways, right? The subtitle is Belief and Belonging in an Age of Doubt. And just reading just the description, for all its beneficial advances, our secular age has also weakened some people's ties to religious belief and affiliation. Latter-day Saints have not been immune to this trend.
That's absolutely right. Yeah, I mean, this is the most personal book I've written. It's really a book to the church, and I'm part of the community. It's a community I care about a lot, and so it's absolutely true that we see this across all religions in the United States and Western Europe. This is not unique to Mormonism, but Latter-day Saints are not immune to this, and so we've seen higher rates of disaffiliation, of disaffection with the church over in the 21st century than we saw in previous generations. So this book was an attempt of mine, after hearing people's stories, hearing people struggle with these kinds of things, both people themselves struggling with their faith and trying to figure out what it all means, but also their parents and friends and church leaders saying, wait a minute, why did that person stop coming to church all of a sudden? Trying to write a book that would answer some of those questions and maybe provide a little bit of guidance.
Now, this is in part at least a response to a lot of people you've talked to, right?
Yeah.
And heard from. You talk about the age of doubt. What contributes to that, do you think?
Well, there's all kinds of things. I wrote the book primarily addressing, people's questions and doubts around issues of church history. And there are all kinds of issues that come up, whether it be Joseph Smith's character, the translation of the Book of Mormon, polygamy, racial issues, the Mountain Meadows Massacre. I mean, the list goes on. And so that's primarily what the book deals with, is people who have struggled with those kinds of questions. Now, I think what we've seen in the past few years is that the locus of doubt, quote unquote, has shifted a little bit less from those historical issues and more around issues of gender, sexuality, women's roles. And I do think I offer a framework in the book that allows a kind of resilient faith, even in the midst of people's doubts and questions, which I welcome. I think that's part of the human experience. I think we're curious. We are a curious species, and I think that's a good thing. But I think there's a way to hold on to community and hold on to faith, even in a secular age.
Just a couple of minutes for this. You mentioned religious history. Studying history of religion interests you because you say it provides an interesting framework, a good framework to talk about big questions, such as?
Well, for me, I mean, I do so much writing around violence and nonviolence. How is it that can religious communities be mobilized to create conditions of greater peace and justice? We all can point to examples where religious communities have been mobilized for the contrary, for violence and for injustice and for oppression. So I think we have to own up to that history, especially if we are religious individuals. But again, this is all of our history. This is not just for people who are in these communities. And so how do we own up to that history? How do we recognize what led into that history? And then is there a way that we can transform that history, transform religious communities, doctrines, leadership, community in a way to create more just and peaceful societies? I mean, that's my hope.
You took this position, I think, in part to slough off administrative duties and to be able to work on books such as this, right?
Exactly. I was previously dean of the School of Arts and Humanities at Claremont Graduate University, which was a great experience, and I liked many parts of it. But this is where my passion is. I love being in the classroom. I love research and writing, and I've hopefully got a few things to say, and maybe some other people will be interested in them.
All right. And I hope you come back for a future conversation.
Thanks, Tom. I really appreciate it.
Well, we'll be able to treat some of these. The upcoming books include Battles of Zion, Mormonism and Violence. That's the one that's out, is it?
Yeah, it just came out.
And then a future, Weapons of Peace, A Mormon Theology of Nonviolence. That'll be coming out.
Hopefully next year. Fingers crossed.
Out now, What is Mormonism? A Student's Introduction. Also, we've referred to, just briefly, Planted, Belief and Belonging in an Age of Doubt. Tell me again the title of your lecture.
The Politics of Mormon History.
All right. And you can hear that lecture coming up on Wednesday, October 16th. This is the inaugural lecture by historian Patrick Mason, as he's been named the new Leonard J. Arrington Endowed Chair of Mormon History and Culture at Utah State University. Wednesday, October 16th, 7:30 p.m. in the USU Performance Hall on the USU campus. And parking is in the lot across the street to the east of the Fine Arts Center. Golf cart shuttling will be available. It's free and open to the public. Patrick Mason, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
And thanks for listening to Access Utah.
You're listening to Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSUFM Logan. Also heard at upr.org.
UPR is everywhere you are, with classical music programming, news and information, statewide through 36 signals, worldwide on the web at upr.org, and through the new UPR app. UPR is only a push of the button away